Hello, this is Dr. Mary Kay Keller, and I am here today with someone who's going to talk about highly sensitive children. She's an LCSW with 33 plus years of experience working with families, consulting with preschool programs, training pediatric residents, and writing about and training professionals on early childhood development. Her work in the trenches and with families struggling with the range has been with Her work has been in the trenches with families struggling with a range of child rearing challenges that are largely rooted in their child's highly sensitive temperament. So now I'm going to introduce you to Claire Lerner. Claire, I understand that the importance of understanding the meaning of children's behaviors, the role temperament plays in influencing children's behavior. It's the why of what they do and why they do it. So I'm just going to turn it over to you and please share with us what you would like to talk about.
Well, I think where you began is a very good starting place, which is, you know, while we may focus in today on highly sensitive children, what we're talking about is temperament. And so I think it's first important to be really clear about what we're talking about when we're talking about temperament. So temperament is something we're all born with. It's our wiring, it's how we experience the world through our senses, through our experiences in the world. It's something that babies didn't choose, that parents didn't create. It's really their processing system and why you can line up even 10 newborns and expose them to, let's say, a bell ringing and have 10 very different responses, even, you know, to the very, very same stimulus. And it's because the way their brain and neurological system is processing that information is completely unique to that baby. And so that's why I talk about it as helping us understand the why of behavior, right? So when you think of development generally takes a consistent course, right? Babies roll over, then they sit up, then they crawl, then they walk, then they say one word, then they say two words, then they string words together. And while that path may, while babies and young children may gain milestones at different times, there's a broad range, of course, of what we consider, you know, within a typical normal range. It unfolds very similarly for human beings. But temperament helps us explain the why children are doing what they're doing. Why do some children, you know, crawl right into a play group and just start engaging, and other even 6 or 8 month olds are clinging for dear life to their caregiver, you know, or they go to preschool and some kids run in without a care in the world, without looking back, and other kids are much more fearful and cautious. It's why some kids go with the flow. There's a transition, no problem, time to leave the playground. Sure, they put everything down, they run to their parent. And by the way, those kids make their parents look really good because they're just sort of these go with the flow kids who are not hampered by processing these experiences at the deep level that more sensitive children are, where even small transitions, or what we would see as seemingly small transitions or disappointments, right? Like there's only orange juice and they want apple juice. For some kids, it's like, whatever. And then you've got the kids where they completely melt down because their expectation of what would happen was defied, and they get triggered into stress much more quickly. So there's a lot of temperament traits. It would take us hours to go through all of them. The main researchers who look at this area of development were Stella and Chess. So I refer you, and maybe as a follow-up to the podcast, we can give some additional resources, because there are many, many temperamental traits. You know, frustration tolerance, how children experience the world through their senses, their activity level. These are all temperament characteristics that help us understand why children are doing what they're doing. But for today, I think we had talked about focusing on this group of kids who are more highly sensitive. So from a temperament perspective, children who are bigger reactors by nature, who are processing their experiences in the world very deeply, often will get tripped up and more reactive when seemingly minor upsets take place. For example, they want orange juice and the orange juice is gone and they can have apple juice instead. Some kids are going to accept that very readily and will not find that to be a very distressing experience. But for kids who are more reactive by nature, even something as seemingly minor as that can be experienced as a major upset and can lead to a meltdown. And so when you see those kinds of differences in reactivity, it's not always temperament, but we always want to look at the temperament as being a potential underlying factor.
You know, I have a question, Claire. So, and I've read about highly sensitive children off and on over the years, but I wonder sometimes, are they highly sensitive or do we perceive them as being highly sensitive because we have like a template in our head of how children are supposed to evolve? And this is like when you're talking about temperament, temperament feels so much different to me. It's kind of like personality. You know, as adults, we accept that we have different types of personality. And maybe possibly children just have a variety of temperaments. And you, do you know what I'm saying? Like more like it's been a collective conscious choice to believe that children should be a certain way rather than realizing that they, you know, they come in all different types of temperaments.
Well, I think it's important to differentiate between temperament and personality. So personality is something that develops over time. Okay. You know, based on your experiences in the world. Temperament is a little different because it's actually something that's constitutional and innate. Like I was saying earlier, it's something you can detect in the first 6 months of a baby's life based on how they are processing information from the environment and reacting to it. So like I was saying earlier, babies who are more reactive temperamentally may have a bigger reaction to changes in temperature, changes in, or, you know, big sounds in their environment, or things looking different in your house. You know, you move a chair, you move a table. Sometimes these highly sensitive kids who are very tuned into their surroundings will have a big reaction to those kinds of changes, changes in caregivers. Those are all things that are highly impacted by temperament, which is very different than personality, which develops over time. They're intertwined in some way, but they're not the same. So I think that's one important sort of differentiation that we want to make. But I think you're also, you know, making another really good point, which is it's very, very hard to tease out why a child is doing what they're doing, because it's not just temperament. When I work with families, what I find most helpful when we're trying to decode the meaning of behavior, why their child's doing what they're doing, so that we can get to the root cause and address the root cause, which is really what's going to be most helpful to children, right? You can line up 10 kids having a knockdown, dragout tantrum, but if we don't figure out what is triggering that stress response, we're not going to be very effective at helping the child with that, with whatever it was that, you know, caused the distress, which might be very different for different children. So when I'm working with families to understand what does this behavior mean, why is your child biting? Why is your child staying to himself at school and feeling uncomfortable participating with the other kids? Why does your child fly off the handle when you give him his cereal in the red bowl instead of the blue bowl when it's the exact same cereal? Like when we're trying to figure these things out, we're looking at three big, what I think of as sort of variables. One is just development. Like, what is going on for this child developmentally? Is there a developmental issue, first of all, right? Like, is there a speech or a cognitive or a motor issue that is at play here? Because we know that those are important factors to take into consideration. So if a child, let's say, does not have great use of language, then we're going to expect that they're going to act out more because they're not going to have the words to use to express themselves, right? If a child isn't processing information accurately, that's a key factor in understanding why maybe they're acting defiantly or not following directions. So you want to always think, what's the developmental piece? And not just sort of from a skill perspective, but like, what's going on for developmentally at this time for this child? So for example, if they're, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 or 4, we're going to expect that there's going to be this desperate need and constant attempt to control their world. We just know that that's the life of a three-year-old, is they're incredibly clever and they figured out how the world works. And now they're going to try and work that to their advantage. And that we expect at that age, right? There's certain ages we expect there to be more separation anxiety. We expect there's certain times where kids are might have more fears, all based on where they're at developmentally. So that's sort of the developmental bucket. Then you've got the temperament bucket. What's the temperament piece of this puzzle? Sometimes temperament is going to weigh heavily, and sometimes it's not going to be a huge factor. And the third bucket is context. And that's basically, what has this child's experiences in the world been that may be affecting their behavior, right? So that, of course, in this day and age, COVID is major. That's a major contextual factor that is affecting a lot of children. So even kids who previously had been coping really well and not been exhibiting any kind of behavior challenges, all of a sudden, the seismic shift in their worlds due to COVID has now triggered them into stress mode more frequently. And maybe they're having more meltdowns and a lower frustration tolerance and backtracking on potty training or having sleep disruption, right? Like those, that's the power of context to impact a child's behavior. And then, of course, there's things like new babies, major moves, other losses in your family. Those are all contextual factors. So you want to look not just at temperament. You want to look at all these factors to sort of what I think of as doing the detective work to put the pieces of the puzzle together to understand why is your child having this challenge at this moment in time.
How much would you say, that's so fascinating, how much would you say that the emotional connection might play in this? Like I was sharing with you before we started about Mark Brackett and the permission to feel. There's a place in his book where he states that children not having that kind of emotional connection, not that they don't feel connected to their parents, that's not what I'm saying, but having that kind of relationship where people are expressing things in emotional vocabulary, you know, is something, and I've noticed it over the years in myself and other people around me working with families and children, that a lot of times we aren't identifying our own emotions, let alone somebody else's. So when a child is acting out, maybe they're having a tantrum, obviously there's feelings of frustration. There's probably a slew of feelings. I used to do an anger management course and people would come in and they'd say, I want to never get angry again. I'd say, well, that's not possible, but let's talk about what's going on underneath the anger, because anger isn't a real emotion. It's actually a cover emotion for an explosion of different feelings. And so that was really fascinating to me. So, I'm kind of curious as to how emotional vocabulary might enhance parents and children's interactions, especially during these times when there's such a frustration level of maybe trying to figure out what's going on with the child and what's happening in their world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always going to be critically important, no matter what. There's a robust body of research that shows that helping children connect to their emotions, to feel validated and seen and understood is critically important. In fact, Tina Bryson and Dan Siegel have just written a new book that's all about the critical importance of children being seen, you know, basically not judged, understood, tuned into, and validating their experience in the world without judgment. So that becomes especially important in these very challenging moments with kids when they're melting down or they're making super irrational demands, and we're as adults much more likely to get triggered into reactive mode, which is not helpful for anyone. You know, those encounters when we're not able to connect emotionally in a positive way with our children can be extremely problematic, not just for the child, but for the parent. You know, by the time many parents come to see me, they are racked with guilt and shame and very, very difficult emotions about the kinds of things they're saying to their children and the way they're responding, because they're so at their wit's end. And largely it's because it's all interconnected, because their reactions often are rooted in feeling like their child is purposefully misbehaving. You know, that their child is purposefully being defiant or trying to work their last nerve or be physically harmful to them when they hit or kick or bite or spit. And what we know is that children don't misbehave on purpose. In those moments, they don't have the ability or the skill to manage whatever is triggering their stress. And that's going to change dramatically from one child to another, again, based on their age, based on their temperament. So again, like, that's where temperament is such an important variable, that kids who are big reactors by nature are going to be much more impulsive. So, you know, maybe another three-year-old is able to use his words when he's frustrated, but another three-year-old, his reactivity level is going to supersede his thinking skills. And so he may lash out and throw something, or just have a huge, you know, tantrum in the middle of the grocery store. And so once you understand and you see this from an empathetic perspective, that your child's just having a hard time coping, and what he needs from you is empathy and support. And so being able to, let's say to this child in the grocery store, I know, it's really frustrating when you can't have a candy bar. Your brain was telling you, you really wanted that candy bar and we got one last time. And now you're really, really distressed and your whole mind and body is losing control. I'm your helper and I'm gonna put you safely in the cart so we can finish shopping and you're gonna be okay. That kind of response, where you acknowledge the child's experience and then provide the appropriate limit and boundary that they need to cope and regain control, is really what we're angling for. It's not love or limits, it's both. And that's something that parents, I find, really struggle with, is that they bifurcate this. They feel like either they're being loving and connected and empathetic and connecting emotionally, or they're disciplining. And actually, I don't even use the word discipline anymore because it's so fraught with sort of negativity. You're really a helper. You're both connecting and validating your child's experience while helping them cope. And limits are loving. It's part of the fabric of your relationship with your child, especially in the early years, because children have so little self-control, you know, when they're under 5 or 6, that you're constantly having to set those limits and boundaries to keep them safe. So I know this is a very long-winded answer to your question, but I think it's really important to see being loving and empathetic as not counter to being a really good limit setter and also still having important expectations for your child.
You know, that's not long-winded, and here's why. One of the things that I don't think people really understand is that the word discipline comes from the root term of to teach. You know, it has a negative connotation because we've been misinformed and inappropriately used the word discipline. And I can understand. I've shied away from it myself too, because it seems to come more in with the idea of punishment. And you know, what we know basically, psychologists, that punishment doesn't work. Positive and negative reinforcement both increase behavior, you know. And so, however we're interacting with children, a lot of times as an adult, I know I didn't own it. You know, I made mistakes with my kids, and I'm very out there about it, because I, you know, as I learned better, I did better. But not having come from a family that was highly nurturing, it was really a challenge. And I just had to trust that when things didn't feel good to me, that I needed to go deeper and find out what went wrong there. And I know that, you know, not everybody does that. People have said to me it's kind of a unique attribute, but I think we all possess it, to be honest with you. I just think we don't take the time to take a deep breath sometimes. And our culture really comes across like, you know, I grew up during a time period when children were to be seen and not heard. You know, it's not like we had that kind of connection. Another book that I just ran into here recently, and I'm trying to remember her name, it's a doctor, but she talks about the difference between connection versus compliance. And you know, that was a huge awareness for me too, because a lot of our parenting programs, I've realized we evaluate them on how the parent determines how effective it is, rather than going in and finding out how the child feels about the changes, which to me is just manipulation, rather than the connection piece of it. You know, that we need to go deeper into connecting with our children rather than expecting compliance from them all the time, you know. And something you said earlier, I wanted to kind of revisit. When we're more concerned about how other people see us as a parent, we're parenting more, and I'm not saying everybody's narcissistic, but we're parenting more from a narcissism base, in the sense of it's about us, rather than being most deeply concerned about the impact on the child and, you know, what messages that we're sending to them. So I really admire your work, and I think this is an incredibly valuable conversation that we're having today.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I thank you for, you know, for making it happen, because it really does enable us to elucidate a lot of things that I think are not necessarily in parents' consciousness, but is really very empowering to them, actually. So, for example, going back to this whole idea of connection versus compliance, that, you know, makes me think about, again, all the families I work with and how they have this sort of dichotomy in their head that they're either connecting or they're disciplining. And actually, in the process of teaching your child and helping them learn to cope with life's myriad frustrations and disappointments, and when things can't go the way you want them to go, that is one of your most important times of connection. It's actually helping children through those challenging moments where your greatest bonding happens. I mean, think about it for us as adults, right? Usually the people we treasure most in our life, you know, it's great to have fun with our friends and our family, but usually the people we have the deepest connection to are the people who we go to when we're struggling, who listen, who make us feel seen, who help us gain perspective, who show empathy for our experience, and who can tolerate our upset and our anger and our sadness. And the same rules apply for parents and kids. I think once parents see that, their job is not to make it all better. That's another one of sort of those faulty mindsets, that it's the parent's job to sort of make those difficult feelings go away. When those feelings children struggle with, you know, about, you know, not feeling the best at something, or not having been included in some, you know, social activity, or feeling like a failure because, you know, their drawing wasn't exactly what they expected or wanted it to be, or their anger at not getting more screen time, like any of those typical things, those are feelings and experiences that child has to learn to work through. So it should be freeing to parents to know that your job isn't to respond by minimizing or avoiding or just cheerleading, as I call it, like, oh no, you're so smart, your drawing is the best. That's not what kids want or need. What they want is to be seen, to say, wow, you know, you had an idea in your brain about what you wanted this picture to look like, and I hear you saying that it doesn't come out the way you liked. Tell me more about that. That's what kids want. They don't want you to solve all your problems, just like most of us adults don't go to people for support who just tell us what to do. And so I think this concept of, like, what does connection actually mean really needs to be redefined as even in those most difficult moments when your child is struggling with really difficult feelings and experiences is when your greatest connection is happening.
Totally agree. I just love that. And, you know, I've often heard, as when I worked in substance abuse, that connection is the opposite of addiction. And I think that's because when we aren't connected, they feel lost and abandoned emotionally, if nothing else, you know, and that's huge. What I was hearing you say, it was almost like parents need to become more like coaches rather than the cheerleaders. Because coaches, you know, I remember, especially with my kids when they were involved in sports, that I really valued certain coaches that saw them and saw their strengths, helped them acknowledge that they had those strengths, and then helped them play to their weaknesses, you know, in such a way that didn't diminish them, but actually encourage them. And I realized we were living in an area where we had a lot of coaches that were very family oriented. And I know that's not everybody's experience, but I think of good coaching, you know, with parents, because I do think there's too much pressure on parents as society that, you know, your child needs to conform, they need to do this. There's all these, like, these do's and don'ts in our heads, rather than realizing that, like you just said, really being there for them and supporting them while they're problem solving, not solving the problems for them. I was a single parent, and I'll share a quick story with you. So my teenage daughter came home one day and she says, I'm exhausted. I just need a break from school. Well, there wasn't a holiday coming up and it wasn't like it was spring break, you know? And she says, Mom, I just really need to take a week off. She said, I need some downtime. And I heard her and I said, you know, I hear you. It's just that as your mom, I have some challenges because the school's not going to, you know, comply with this just because you're having a hard time. So what I did was, is I gave her, and I can't even remember what it was now, it's been too long ago, but I gave her three things. I said, if you can satisfy these three things, these three situations and how this would work and come up with a plan, I said, I'll be glad to, you know, support that and I'll take it to your teachers. Well, a few days passed by, and then finally I got curious and I said, have you come up with a plan? She says, oh yeah. She says, I'm over it. She says, that was more exhausting trying to figure that out. She says, I'm fine. And I thought, you know, there was no drama. There was no drama. She came to her own logical conclusion that it just wasn't going to work, you know? And she said, you know, I'd rather just go face what I need to face, you know? And so she worked it out on her own, you know? And we don't need to be the resource for all answers in the universe, because quite frankly, I realized as a parent, I'm not an expert on my child's life and their decision-making. I get to be there and guide them and coach them, but really helping them, supporting them in a way that they can make and believing that they can make good decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I love that story, and you know, it speaks for itself, but it does, you know, emphasize the power of listening and acknowledging your child's experience, not trying to take it away, not trying to make it all better. And giving them, I know it was inadvertent, but in some ways you gave her space to figure it out herself and come to her own solution. And it's funny, you know, I often think about, you know, my two kids and how my daughter's experience was so vastly different than my son's, because she was my second child. And while I was, you know, busy sort of responding to him, and she often had to wait. So, you know, she'd be screaming that she was having trouble with a puzzle. And I would say, okay, I hear you. It's going to be a few minutes. I'll be there when I can. And by the time I got there, she had solved the problem. And it was one of those aha moments where I realized I'm such a rescuer and a fixer by nature. You know, I'm pretty anxious myself, you know, and my wiring. And so I get into gear really quickly, not just solving my own problems, but trying to take everybody else out of their misery. And in that, I was not allowing my children the space they need to solve their own problems, and also to communicate to them that I believed in them, that they did have the ability to solve their own problems. And so I think that this is one of those, again, like faulty mindsets that we fall into as parents, where we're misinterpreting what our children really need in that moment, because we get activated and triggered into reactive mode, and it shuts down a process of being able to really take a step back and think, I hear what my child says she wants right now, but what does she really need? Because often we're reacting to sort of the immediate demand without really understanding what our child is really trying to tell us. And I think your story sort of elucidates that so powerfully.
Oh, thank you. You know, and I have to say, she was my middle child. I think that you hit on something. Firstborn children, and I was the firstborn child. We're just kind of wandering through trying to figure it out the first time through, especially when, like I said, I did not have an optimal nurturing childhood. And so I knew what I didn't want to do when I had my son, and I hadn't gone to college yet. I didn't have any child development issues. It was just me and my intuition and my heart. And so there were times there when I look back on it and think, oh, I really blew it here. But then I'm kind of amazed at different points and times, like it just seemed at really critical moments, somehow my intuition knew I needed to go this direction, but I didn't actually know what I was doing. And I had to trust that. And in some ways I was successful, but I do think with firstborn children, it's like there's a whole different dynamic there, in the sense that we're trying so hard to be our best parent right up front. And by the time we get to the second and third one, I'm not saying that, I just think I was more relaxed, a little more relaxed on myself, you know, and I thought, okay, the basic things like, you know, getting them fed and keeping them alive were all taken care of with the first one. But it allowed me to go to a deeper connection, you know, with the second and the third child. And you know, and that's, as a firstborn child, I can see that with my parents too, you know, that things were a little bit different, you know, the more kids that they had. So, you know, I do think there's a special kind of, what's the word I'm trying to look for? There's, you know, that first time through, it's our first time through. I was thinking, you know, earlier you were talking about the different types of temperaments. I was wondering if we could kind of explore some, maybe some practical applications for parents, like talk about the different types of sensitivities and temperaments that go, you know, and maybe give them some idea of examples of how to handle things. Is there anything that comes to mind to you that, or, you know, as you've done this with parents, the things that you've seen the most, or even the things that you've seen the least that might be just as, you know, important to parents to hear about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's countless. You know, I mean, this is what I spend my day doing, is, you know, consulting with parents. You know, they come to me with a challenging behavior, and then we're doing the detective work together. So I can certainly share with you, you know, a number of very typical kinds of scenarios that might arise. So, I mean, just drawing from this past week, I had a family come to me yesterday. They have a four-year-old who was completely potty trained, including for night, and a pretty adaptable kid overall, and always, though highly sensitive, like a child that they described who was super empathetic and very tuned into other people's emotions. And those kids tend to get overwhelmed more easily because they're so tuned in. It's like they don't have a filter. It's like everything comes through and they're processing everything at such a deep level. It's like their brains never turn off. So these kids do tend to get overwhelmed more easily, and therefore you will often see more challenging behaviors. For this child, he actually, did not have a lot of challenges, but now you have, the family was living abroad. They had to come home very suddenly. They changed homes 3 times when they got back to the United States. They had a new baby. And this child started a new school, and within that first new school year, changed classrooms within the first month. So this is a great example of how you've got a kid who has been coping pretty well, but now there's this confluence of many changes in his world, which he takes very hard. That those changes are something that he experiences deeply, talks a lot about missing his friends and teachers where they used to live, talking about feeling like his parents don't have enough time for him because now they have this new baby, missing the different homes he's lived in. So he's very verbal and clear that these have, been experienced pretty intensively for him. So now he's having many bedwetting incidents at night. He is tuning out and they're very frustrated because they feel like he's not listening and cooperating. He also is just melting down more easily and getting more frustrated and starting to be a little physical, like pushing them away and throwing things. And these are all actually pretty new behaviors for him. So as we did the detective work, the contextual factor was obvious, but the temperament piece was big and very important for these parents to become aware of, that when he was becoming physical, it wasn't because he was purposefully trying to hurt them. It's because right now, because of his stress level, he has less self-control. And by the way, this is true for us as adults too, right? Like the example I always think of is, if you have had like a really chill morning and things went well and you're feeling pretty calm about family life and your work life and you get in your car and someone cuts you off, you're like, okay, whatever. You can handle it. But if you've had a really stressful morning and things are spiraling out of control and things are going haywire at work, and now someone, cuts you off while you're driving and you are in like all out road rage. And it's because when our systems are stressed, our psychic energy gets diverted to survival. And we don't have the same coping resources that we have when we are feeling more comfortable and not stressed. And so that helped us understand the range of behaviors that he's engaged in. And the not listening really boiled down to, once we, really dissected a range of examples of that, that he's not being purposely defiant. He's very preoccupied. And so he gets sort of zoned out in his own world, and he's not even processing the direction his parents are giving him or the teachers, because the teachers are also reporting this. And so what we did was we came up with a cueing system where we said to him, we'll just call him Jason, Jason, we know sometimes you're not necessarily hearing the information we want to communicate to you. So what we're going to do from now on is we're going to give you a little press on your right shoulder when we want your attention. And that's the signal to pause what you're doing and to pay attention to the grown-up, so we can give you the information you need about what's going to happen next. And that worked beautifully, because it really got to the root of the issue, which is that he was tuned out and he needed a more intensive, even physical experience to sort of turn his brain off from his coloring or his block building in order to actually process the information he needed to cooperate. When it came to the bedwetting at night, my suggestion was to completely let that go. That is not a functional problem for a 4-year-old. If he had been having like accidents all day long and couldn't go to school because of it, that might have been different. But in this case, We had an easy solution. And what I suggested was that they just say to him, you know what, bud, no problem. Sometimes our brain is not telling our body what it needs when we're in a really deep sleep. So we're just going to use this pull-up. So this way your bed can stay dry. You don't have to worry about it. And if you do wake up and need to go to the bathroom, what's awesome is that pull-ups are just like underwear, and you can go to the bathroom, you can pull them down like underwear, you can pull them back up. But this way it's a non-issue. We just wanted to take that off his plate of another stressor that was completely unnecessary to expect of him. And then when it came to the physicality, what we did was the parent just said to him, look, bud, we know that when you're frustrated, sometimes you're having a hard time, your brain is flooded with big feelings, and it's hard for your body to stay in control. We know you do not mean to be hurtful. We know that you do not mean to hurt mommy or daddy or your caregiver. At the same time, it is our job to keep you safe. And so here's what we're gonna do. And what we did was we just created like a big basket of all sorts of, like, you know, basically foam and you know, other kinds of objects that he could easily smash, push, hit, and that would be acceptable. And so when he went to sort of swat at his mom because, you know, she wouldn't give him, you know, another half hour of, you know, Paw Patrol or whatever it might be, she could say, oh, remember, we don't push people. People have feelings. Let's find something you can push. Because I find it actually not very helpful to just tell kids to constantly stop doing something, because often they are purging themselves of something and they're meeting a need, and we have to find an alternative that's acceptable. So I know that was a very long-winded story, but it's a nice way of showing how the process of detective work looks and how you can actually be a really good loving limit setter while remaining very, very loving and connected to your child.
Well, you know, I didn't consider it long-winded at all. What I was most impressed with was the initial reaction of saying that we know this is not who you are, that this is about, you know, more about what's going on inside of you. To me, that's a very empathic, it's empathy. You know, to be able to see a child and see their frustration and not attribute some kind of a negative motivation to it. Any child would feel empathy, you know, from that parent. And that's a huge part, you know, a huge part of connection with children is through the emotions. And then to offer alternative solutions feels supportive. You know, so you've got empathy, and then you've got the emotional support that they need there that tells them that you're a safe person to come to. You know, I've often struggled sometimes when I was working in child abuse prevention with parents who still felt like hitting was an option, you know, and I said, if you're the person hurting them, how are they supposed to come to you? You know, how are they supposed to be honest with you? And so, you know, I thought those were great responses. And you're talking about highly sensitive children, but I think that's just good parenting across the board.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important to... this issue of parental mindsets is huge, that often parents are reacting from that mindset that their child, like that there's some malicious intent on the part of their child, that they're purposefully trying to embarrass them or work their last nerve or be uncooperative. Once you help parents see it from the perspective of the child and that the child is just struggling and needs support, it's a beautiful moment, because what it does is it frees the parent to feel more loving towards their child, and by the way, also to feel much better about themselves as a parent. Because what inevitably happens, and you and I know this, is that when your child is acting out, it feels awful as a parent, because there's a part of you that feels like, where did I go wrong? Like, what happened here that I have a child who could be hurling venom at me? Because that's something kids do, right? They're really mad, they're worked up, they say, you're a poopy-faced daddy, or I hate you, or I wish you would leave this house. I mean, kids say outrageous things when they're in high stress mode that they don't mean. If you look at that and you think, oh my gosh, you know, where did this child come from? I'm such a nice, kind person. and, you know, how did I create this monster? Then you're going to respond in a way that's very harsh and punitive when your child doesn't mean that at all. Your child's just saying, I don't know how to deal with this and I need your help. And so, you know, to that point, I actually have a book coming out, and maybe I'm not supposed to use this for self-promotion, but because it's so, I wrote it for this exact reason, that in my work with families, I identified 8 very specific faulty parental mindsets that led parents down a path that was not only not helpful to their child or to the parent-child relationship, but often exacerbated problems instead of solving problems. And so through that book, I elucidate these mindsets and then show case after case on, you know, every topic you could think of: potty learning, mealtime, tantrums, you know, physical aggression, how correcting those mindsets and making some important mind shifts can help you do this detective work and really see what your child's trying to tell you so that you can maintain a close positive connection while you are still being a really good loving limit setter.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Why Is My Child in Charge?
I'm so glad you mentioned it. That's exactly what these podcasts are for.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to look it up myself.
Yeah, well, it's just so you know, it's in production right now. So it's going to come out in fall of 2021, I think September. Great. And it is a very, very actionable book. There are so many good books out there about temperament, about your child being seen, about positive discipline. What I'm really trying to do in this book is sort of go the next step and really unpack some of these very complex parent-child dynamics and challenges and play out how we come up with a plan. For example, the story I just told you, that's a perfect example of how we go through this process to really figure out what's the development piece, what's the temperament piece, what's the context piece, and what does your child really need from you in this moment in time to get parents out of the mode of reacting on these mindsets that, you know, my child's doing this on purpose, another biggie that we haven't touched on, Mary Kay, is the faulty mindset that you can actually control your child and make them do something.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's a biggie. You know, most parents go into parenting think that like that's their job, to kind of make their child behave, when in fact only the child controls their behavior and their voices and what they say and what they do. Our job as parents is to control the situation through our responses. And I've given, you know, many examples of that just in our conversation today, that like you can't make a child stop having a tantrum, but you can respond in a way that makes it more likely that child is going to be able to regroup if you're calm, if you're their rock, if you're loving, if you're not trying to talk them out of their feelings, if you're providing a safe boundary for them, like that kid freaking out in the grocery store. If you're trying to control them, you're going to be yelling, and if you don't stop running, and all sorts of threats and bribes to try and get the child to cooperate, versus just saying, I know it's really hard, but in the grocery store, we need to be safe. So you can either walk holding my hand, or I'll be a helper and put you in the cart, and provide a response that's actually loving and supportive and that you actually have control over.
You know, that is such an incredible statement right there. And I have another quick story for you, if you don't mind. So with my oldest one.
No, of course not. It's your podcast.
You know, when he was born, I mean, he came out screaming. He was not happy about being born. and he was redheaded, and he had a highly sensitive, I realize looking back on it now, he did have a highly sensitive personality. But his first reactions for a lot of things were meltdowns, you know. And as a mother, you know, I was really challenged right off the bat and didn't know what I was doing. Like I said, you know, I didn't have a good structure, you know, a modeling structure for my own childhood. but I just knew that I needed to deal with him in the moment, you know. And I really didn't feel that sense of bad parenting until I would get out into public. Like, I had my own way of dealing with his meltdowns, and they worked really well for him and really well for me. But I would get into public, and then you get these people, you know, that would look at you like, you know, why aren't you controlling your child? You know, and that was always a huge challenge. But when he was a teenager, he said something to me one time that really woke me up to this idea of what I call narcissistic parenting. And I don't mean that in a cruel way. I just mean that we're more concerned sometimes about how we look as a parent than actually just being a parent. And he said something, I was commiserating over something, you know, that had happened. And he said, "Mom." And I said, "What?" He said, "You don't get to take credit for my successes. So why are you trying to take credit for my failures?"
Wow.
And that was huge. I mean, he taught me something so valuable in that moment.
Yeah.
And it really made me pull back and say, you know, you're right. You get to make your own choices. And here's the thing. I don't think that most of us really understand. I was watching a TV show. It was Blue Bloods. And they come together as a police family. They come together on Sundays for this big family dinner. And one series in particular just really grabbed me. Like, I kept rewinding it. And they said, "We're going to talk about our failures." And the kids were like, "Talk about our failures." And he said, "Yeah, you're going to fail forward." And all of a sudden, I realized, why do we have such a huge emotional reaction to the word failure? Failure is actually another time in which we learn something. So I saw this famous quote one time from Thomas Edison. Someone had said to him, "How many times did it take you before you figured out the light bulb?" And I mean, it was thousands. I think it was somewhere around 7,000 and something. And somebody said, "Didn't you feel like a failure?" And he said, "A failure?" He said, "I learned 7,000 ways it didn't work." You know,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
You know, and it was huge. It was revolutionary, changed our whole living experience, you know, and just to be able to take that away so that parents can, you know, be more connected, not only to themselves, but to their children, and just drop the societal expectations, you know, of what a parent should or should not be, I think is huge. If there was anything I could give to any one of my adult children, it would be that.
Yeah. And that's, by the way, that's one of the mindsets, you know, and the shifts is that, you know, failure is, you know, the stress of failure, the faulty mindset is that the stress of failure is detrimental to children. And so our knee-jerk reaction then is to make it all better and to swoop in and fix the problem to reduce the child's negative feelings. That's what a lot of us are doing as parents when we're triggered in that way. But when you make the mind shift that you just described, where you are, you see failure as a part of learning, then you're much more likely when your child is frustrated to just join them. And again, thinking about that like connection, that you might sit next to your toddler and say, "I know. Puzzles are so frustrating. They are really, really hard. I totally get why you would be really struggling right now because they're really hard. Let's see, how might we solve this problem?" And you, if you can see yourself, like you said earlier, as a coach or a facilitator as opposed to a fixer, you are going to be giving your child an amazing gift, because if you swoop in, what you're doing is sending two very unfortunate messages. One is that you can't solve your problems, only adults can.
Yes.
And you're saying to them, "I don't believe in you.
Yes.
I don't believe you have the ability to solve this problem, so I'm gonna solve it for you." And that's exactly the opposite message that we want to send our kids.
Exactly, because the whole point is to get them launched. And this is the thing that I don't think we think about when we're young parents, you know, early on. I've since come to the conclusion, and it's nice that my granddaughter kind of supports me in this too. I said, "I don't think you should be a parent before you're at least 25. I mean, 30 might even be better, because I've seen some amazing parents as we, you know, as our brains have developed and become more mature. But basically, the whole goal is not to make them dependent on us, because we're not going to outlive them.
Yeah.
And sometimes I don't think we realize that, you know, get them launched so that they're, you know, they have a wonderful life, and that it's of their choosing, and that it continues past us. The older I get, the more aware I am of my time limit, you know, and just hope that, you know, their lives after me go on to be, you know, even more amazing than it already is. It's not to want to clip their wings so that I can keep them close beside me, but to, you know, like those birds when they first get to see a baby bird actually take off and fly away, you know. And it's not about being happy that, you know, I'm no longer responsible for them. It's just about enjoying. To me, they're a precious gift, and having them in my life is just an amazing journey for whatever time that we travel together.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. So Mary Kay, I think what I'd like to close with, and it's picking up on something you said earlier, which is that what I've come to think of as perfect parenting is, of course, not like making no mistakes. Like that's just not possible. It's really perfect parenting is when things aren't going the way you'd like, or your child's exhibiting some kind of behavior that you're concerned about, or you're, you know, responding in ways you're uncomfortable with, or you don't really know exactly what your child needs from you, that you take a step back and you reflect on what you think is going on, what you think your child is trying to tell you, and to make the course corrections necessary to provide what you think your child needs versus what he wants. And actually, the book is actually created to provide parents a tool to be able to do that, because obviously not every parent is going to seek consultation from a child development specialist. Most parents are, you know, really relying on themselves to figure this out. And while I think it would be awesome for every family to be able to engage in a reflective process, that's just not realistic. And so the book provides a way for parents to go through this sort of detective work and to be empowered to solve their own child rearing challenges, because being a good parent means constantly learning and growing, constantly reflecting and thinking carefully about what you know about your child and what you think he needs to thrive. And that to me is perfect parenting. Not, you know, having a child who never acts out, who never has a tantrum, or being a parent who never loses your cool. It's really about a commitment to constantly learning and growing.
Well, Claire, thank you so much for presenting to the podcasting community and parents everywhere, and for being the change. How would you like for people who may want to contact you? What venues are you on? Social media? Would you prefer it through your email or your website? Would you like to let them know how they can best contact you?
So, I mean, my website is a good entree. It has all my contact information. I'm on Instagram as at Learner Child Development. I'm on all the social channels. I have a newsletter that I send out every few weeks that, you know, provides vignettes of some of the detective work I was talking about. That I just finished a big series on highly sensitive children, going, you know, each week focusing on a different aspect, like, you know, having a trouble losing, low frustration tolerance, perfectionism, managing big emotions. So my newsletter goes in a little deep on some of these developmental issues and challenges. So that's another vehicle, but people can pretty much find it all through my website.
And Claire,
which is just learnerchilddevelopment.com.
That's what I was just going to say. Learner Child Development. That's LERNER childdevelopment.com. And exactly. I want to tell our guests or our listeners today, thank you so much for joining us. If you have any other suggestions for topics, don't hesitate to drop me a line through the app, the podcast app. And also, if you want to support these podcasts and find them valuable, for as little as 99 cents a month, you can support and donate to support the podcast. Claire, thank you so much for joining us today. And it was just delightful to be able to explore this topic and present this for parents and children everywhere. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. It's a great contribution, this podcast. So have a great day.